Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are, the 23rd day of September 2013. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find things like the chat room, headonradionetwork.com/chatroom, a fun and scintillating place to carry on a conversation during the program. And you are welcome to participate. No charge involved with that. You can also find there the Listen Live button, which will allow you to get the stream. Of course, if you like to listen on mobile, tablet type, smart device, what have you, two of your best bet apps are TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio. Yay. The podcast address is at Head On Radio, is at the subdomain for The Horn at whiterosesociety.org. Sorry, I get a little confused sometimes. It's Monday, after all. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And this is Moran Monday on The Horn. But before that, well, a couple of announcements. Or an announcement, and it is a significant one. Had some conversations over the weekend and dealt with some, you know, I'm here most every evening, and, you know, I always mention we've got our evening fundraising goal, that kind of thing. But some things arrived in the mailbox and other sources as well. That, well, there's no easy way to say it. If we have not crossed the line for the month of September by Friday, and Friday is the 28th of September, no, 27th of September. There won't be a horn come Monday, September 30th. It's that simple. I don't like talking about things in terms as stark as all this, but it's a fact. Now, October the 24th is our anniversary. And this particular incarnation will be, I've been at this for 10 years, and this particular incarnation will be 8 years old on October the 24th. It could have knocked me down with a feather when I realized that we might not make it to our birthday. We got some help over the weekend. We got much needed help. Thanks to Kristen, and thanks to I'm sorry, I have to pull this up, and I'm not really in the best of frame of minds for doing this sort of thing. Anyway, but we got some help from Charlie. We got some help from Kristen. And all told, that dealt with a little bit of the backlog that we had had. Joe contributed and said, "Hope this helps. Thanks for your hard work." Thank you, Joe. Joe and Kristen and Charlie helped out over the weekend. But the fact of the matter is, let's put it this way. We cannot end September in the red. It's that simple. You all do a great deal toward keeping this going, and have done for years. And this is just one of those moments when... And I don't even like talking in terms like this. Because I've always got in the back of my head Oral Roberts hollering, "God's going to call me home." Well, I hope that doesn't happen. I mean, you know, Oral Roberts is already gone, but you get my meaning. There are bills that absolutely must be paid. That I have begged and caught up with and played, you know, catch up with, we all have here, for months because of, well, it all goes back to about a year ago, and it's just been horrible ever since. All told, the backlog plus what we need to raise Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday would come to about $1,000. The hole is deeper than that. But I think I can push things out a little bit if we can get to there. You know, it's 100 folks at 10 bucks a piece. Thanks, Henry. Thanks tremendously for getting us started this evening. It's just hard to talk about. And, you know, if we go on, you know, it's like something Kate has talked about, you know, that one of these nights folks will tune in and it'll just be all Glockenspiel music all the time. Well, I mean, technically, no. Rick Smith will still be here. But we won't be able to get Dr. Bill or me on the air. Nothing a winning lottery ticket wouldn't fix. So let's have as good a time as we can. Can we have a good time? I don't know. Let's have as good a time as we can with this Moran Monday. And understand that the sooner, if we can meet this goal, the sooner we meet it, the better off we are. Because running right down to the wire isn't going to cut it anymore. No, don't worry. I haven't gotten myself some new and fabulous job with Walmart, and I'm just looking for a reason to quit. No. If I added up everything that we're in the red over, because Marty's asking, and how far in the red are we? It probably comes to near... like I said, it's more than where we are. It's more than what I'm talking about just to keep things going. Thanks, Beth. We can get there. I hope. I sincerely hope. Because on this end, we put in as much as we can, which ain't a lot, because of some... Well, I mean, we've taken a lot of hits in the last year. The derecho... The damage, the structural damage here, the fact that the support we had had for a very, very long time from Cold River Mountain Watch was no longer possible, and a lot of months that we operate in, we don't meet fundraising goals. If you are inclined to put something in the mail, I suggest you do so today or tomorrow. because otherwise it won't reach the mailbox by Friday. If by some amazing circumstance we should be able to raise the sum, and it's right at $1,000 before Friday, I'll let you know. I'll let you know that we've at least shoved the wolf away from the foyer. And off onto the porch, and maybe, depending on how things work out into the yard. I don't think we're ever going to get to be completely free of the wolf. And I don't even like that analogy to begin with, because I like the wolf. Or I like wolves generally. So, understand, please, that when I've been talking about we need to reach our goal, we need to reach our goal, well, it's not a joke. It's not some esoteric or theoretical number. Thank you, Randy. Don't worry about it. Thank you very kindly for what you've done. Because month in and month out, you have made this happen. And we've known it's fragile from the very beginning. So I don't know what more to say. I hope that's, I take no joy in it, like I said. Thanks, Will. Will in the chat room saying, I'm sorry to hear it's so tight. Well, thank you, Will. It's past tight. It's dire. And I guess it just gets that way from time to time. And you know what? It's not like I'm ashamed of this. Because this has always been. This has ever been. Radio by working people for working people. For all that the right wing blathers on, and I hear he just remarried. Congratulations and good luck to him. For all that the right wing blathers on about George Soros's millions upon millions of dollars, I don't know anybody who's getting them. And there's not that Streisand money out there running around either. There's a lesson here. And that lesson here is that anything we want to have, we will have to struggle to have and struggle to keep. Because while I am not vain enough to think that there's some Mr. Burns type sitting out there saying, excellent, the horn is going down, release the hounds. The fact of the matter is, independent broadcasting is not favored because independent broadcasting can occasionally stumble onto some reality that doesn't jibe with the rarefied, non-oxygenated atmosphere breathed most frequently by the for-profit media. Or, for that matter, by people who stride the halls of power. It is Moran Monday. And with it being Moran Monday, I thought we'd back up a little bit. because I got a note from I got a note from Dennis in Kentucky with this link, and it was pretty shocking. And well, I'm pretty sure it's not something most anybody, and God knows not the for-profit media, spends much time thinking about. You may recall that we had a clip of cranky old Grandpa Freedom, Rand Paul's daddy, Ron, last week when he was when he showed up on Morning Jerk, or Joe, to pitch his idea that he wants 20% of America's children to be homeschooled and learn all about what happened after the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor and Lewis and Clark discovered the moon. Well, it turns out, thanks to this story that Dennis sent to me, a story called The Sinister Side of Homeschooling. It turns out that there really is a dark side of homeschooling. The story is by Michelle Goldberg. And it begins thusly. On September 9th, the parents of Hannah Williams, an Ethiopian teenager living in the state of Washington, were convicted of killing her. During the last year of her life, court documents show she had lost almost 30 pounds as she was beaten, denied food, forced to sleep in a barn, and given cold outdoor showers with a garden hose. Most of the time, she was kept barefoot, although she was allowed shoes if there was snow on the ground. Sometimes she was given nothing but a towel to wear. If Williams had been in school, someone might have noticed that she was underdressed and emaciated, but she was homeschooled, and so her parents... I'm surprised we got this far into the paragraph without getting to this part. And so her parents, fundamentalist Christians enthralled to a harsh disciplinary philosophy, had complete privacy to punish her as they saw fit. She died naked, face down in the mud, in their backyard. Did you happen to listen to Dr. Bill today? It was another one of those poleaxe right between the eyes moments. 2 hours of brilliant, genial conversation and observation, and there, right there, in the last 5 minutes of the program, whack! Right upside the head. Again. Only in this case, it was a description of the evolution of humanity's view of the natural world running parallel to the so-called reformation of the church. Much of this I'm familiar with, but you're never familiar with something, or even if you think you're familiar with something, you're never as familiar with it as you thought you were by the time Dr. Bill is done examining it. Goodness me. And unless I completely missed the meaning of his unless I completely missed the meaning of what he was saying, he took in the Protestant Reformation, the rise of the Enlightenment, and it was during the Enlightenment, of course, that that our idea of government was born, out of the works of people like Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, and you get the idea. But after the Enlightenment in the United States came something called the Great Awakening, and I'd always thought of it as an American phenomenon, but Dr. Bill identified it as a worldwide phenomenon. But it was basically, it was essentially a re-examining of religious faith away from the use of the mind. You may recall that we had a discussion here over the last week or so about whether one may know something in one's heart. Well, it is the Great Awakening that led to a lot of that crap. The Great Awakening being an anti-intellectualization of religion in America, and replacing it with the rank emotion that leads to things like speaking in tongues. Dr. Bill specifically referenced speaking in tongues, as a matter of fact. And then the poleaxe came. And that was that evangelicalism had directly led to, and these are my words, not Dr. Pill's, a dumbing down of America's body politic and a coarsening of any previously held ideas of community. And so from something that Dr. Bill spoke about conceptually on his program to this, and it is 22 minutes past the hour. Hannah Williams dies naked, alone, face down in the mud, killed as much by fundamentalist evangelical Christianity as by the foster parents or the parents who wielded it. Michelle Goldberg continues in the story that Dennis sent to me, and this is where it begins to get even more scary. Williams, Hannah Williams, is far from the only homeschooled kid to be tortured or murdered in recent years. Exactly how many is hard to say. Research on homeschoolers is incredibly spotty. And what exists is mostly done by homeschooling advocates. Well, that's not going to skew the sample, is it? But Heather Doney and Rachel Coleman, two women who themselves grew up in homeschooling families, have documented dozens of horrific cases on their website. Homeschooling's Invisible Children, which launched this past May. They aggregate and put into their database as much information as they can get from things like local news stories, official documents. You can search the website, Homeschooling's Invisible Children. You can search it according to fatality, food deprivation, imprisonment, physical abuse, sexual abuse. And Michelle Goldberg notes that since the year 2000, Doney and Coleman have found almost 70 victims of sexual abuse among homeschooled children, and those are just the ones that made the papers. The two researchers, Rachel Coleman and Heather Doney, make a not entirely harmonious pair. On the one hand, Rachel Coleman has a PhD from Indiana University. She studies the role of children in the Christian rite. She does, however, note that while it's probably a tiny fraction who are being thus abused, that the abuse is real. She won't say that homeschool children are more likely to be abused than not. No, that's not the point. The point she makes, according to Michelle Goldberg, is that there is practically no regulation whatsoever in this substratum of American culture. She notes that because there's almost no regulation, abusive situations can be made worse, and parents can be allowed to hide what they're doing to children. Putting it bluntly, she says homeschooling enables parents to isolate children that can enable them to abuse them. Then there's April Duvall. She joined a support group online for women who were raised in fundamentalist homeschooling families. See, it's one thing, I mean, and we do. We have our fun. There's no harm in it. It's one thing to note the prevalent practices of homeschooling families. You know, stuff like this.
And on the third day, God created the Remington bolt-action rifle so that man could fight the dinosaurs and the homosexuals.
Amen.
And that's cute. It also has a smattering of reality to it, because I think it is safe to say that the vast majority of homeschooled children are homeschooled because they have parents in weirdo religious outfits that don't want them learning that demon evolution. April Duvall's experience with homeschooling was such that her father, who was a right-wing evangelical pastor, he worried that he'd get in trouble if he left marks on her after he beat her, so they pulled her out of school so that no one would ever see the marks that Daddy left in the name of Jesus. Michelle Goldberg cites another story in the article from this past August. Erica Lynn Parsons, 15 years old, from North Carolina, a child of adoptive parents, eventually was reported missing by her stepbrother. That's when folks figured out she hadn't been seen since 2011. And then the scary stuff. In 10 states, homeschooling is entirely unregulated. In 15 more, all parents have to do is say, hey, we're going to be teaching the kids at home. No minimum educational standards, no curriculum review, no testing, no monitoring. Now, that's not the case here in West Virginia, because, by God, Agnes and I had to go over and prove that we were marginally competent to teach our son. We had to design a curriculum. You get the idea. April Duvall taught herself from textbooks via Bob Jones University. You probably got a pretty good idea. You know, Jesus was on the boat with George Washington as he crossed the Delaware. Right. Lewis and Clark traveled with the Holy Spirit. Thomas Jefferson was a fundamentalist. That kind of stuff. So, it turns out that there's a lot more resources out there for homeschooling parents to protect them in case anybody would like to see to the well-being of the children than there are any resources to protect the children. Here's another homeschooling success story. The story of Kenneth Brandt, convicted last year of raping and prostituting his adopted homeschooled sons. And then a little more detail on Hannah Williams. Michael and Debbie Pearl are the fundamentalist evangelicals who got hold of her parents. They're all about the wife being totally submissive to her husband and children being totally submissive to both parents. They have written a book that has been read by scores, thousands, perhaps millions of people. The name of that book is To Train Up a Child. And according to these monsters, you're supposed to start, really, not kidding, you're supposed to start whipping your child with a thin cane branch when they're just a few months old, just to get them used to it. On page 9 of To Bring Up a Child, they describe whipping their own four-month-old daughter. On page 2, they say that the bare skin of every child, should Christian and non-Christian alike, should be whipped. Every transgression should result in a whipping. On page 19, parents who don't whip their children are referred to as indifferent, lazy, careless, neglectful. And on page 45, these servants of compassionate Christ say that if you don't whip your baby from the time that it's a baby, you are, and I quote, creating a Nazi. If a baby can't sleep and cries in the night, you whip them. If your 12-month-old baby girl is crying, you whip her. If a 7-month-old screams, you whip it. She talks, Debbie Pearl, co-author, talks about whipping the bare leg of a 15-month-old. And that's because the 15-month-old didn't play with something the 15-month-old was told to play with. And this was when she was babysitting. This is someone else's child that she whipped. Then she describes hitting a 2-year-old so hard, quote, a karate chop like wheeze came from somewhere deep inside. They advocate whipping a 3-year-old until he is, and this is their words, these are their words, totally broken. If a baby cries for his mama, whip him. They also say that if a child changes his ways and obeys before the whipping starts, whip the kid anyway. Then this little Jim, if you have to sit on him to spank him, then do not hesitate and hold him there until he is surrendered. Prove that you are bigger, tougher. Defeat him totally. Tantrums are to be met with whippings. If a child is screaming and won't stop screaming, quote, don't be bullied. Give him more of the same. Keep whipping the child until the child's cries become those of a wounded, submissive whimper. After you start with the thin twigs, you can move up in the world to a belt or larger tree branch. If mama is nursing baby, it's okay to pull baby's hair to get baby to unlatch from the breast. If a baby falls down and bumps her head on the floor, ignore it. Ignore skinned knees. If your child is roughed up by peers, rejoice. If children should happen to lose their shoes, quote, let them go without until they can make the money to buy more. This isn't a joke. This isn't from The Onion. This is what First Amendment religious freedom gets you in the United States of America, wherein said First Amendment has been reduced to little more than a life support system for the religion industry for people like the Pearls. Michael Pearl, husband of Debbie, who probably whips her, said he was very proud of a set of parents who refused to take their child to the doctor, so that the child was so sick that when he finally got to a doctor, the doctor expressed amazement that he was still alive. Michael Pearl also says that if mommy or daddy aren't around, but the baby has a 10-year-old sibling, the 10-year-old should be able to whip the 2-year-old. 10-year-olds ought to be mature enough to discipline a smaller child. In our house, there was no difference between the parents of the older children enforcing the rule of law over younger children. If a 3-year-old screams, they say, without saying a word, go straight to the switch. Spank her where she stands. Never threaten and never show mercy. One squeak of a scream gets a switching. And then this, and this is probably the comedy moment of the whole piece. Michael Pearl says that if your child misbehaves by doing something to some other child, like, you know, hits, bites, kicks, then you should give your child a thorough spanking. And no, this is a real quote. Children must be taught that violence is never an acceptable alternative in personal conflicts. And this, I don't offer you all of this as some means of simply pointing out, you know, oh, look at those crazy fundamentalists. No. These things tie into larger issues. You ever wonder why somebody would climb the tower at the University of Texas and take out a rifle and start plugging people? Or why a guy would go into the Navy Yard and start shooting? Or why, I don't know, or why a child who was left with his nanny the day they buried his baby sister would grow up and slaughter a million people in Iraq because he tried to kill my daddy. Here you go. It seems that there's nothing that Mr. and Mrs. Pearl don't think is an appropriate use of the switch. Now, these are the people that Hannah Williams's parents were following in determining how to homeschool their kids. By the way, more than 500,000 copies of To Train Up a Child have been sold. And it turns out being a follower of the Pearls is really bad for your... if your parents are are followers of the Pearls, your life is going to be hell. In 2010, some followers of the Pearls killed 7-year-old Lydia Schatz. They beat her to death for mispronouncing a word. And as is noted here, this is often meted out most frequently on adopted children, because adopted children come into a home with its own bizarre norms and have to be beaten into acceptance. Now, naturally, if anybody steps up and says, you know, we ought to do something about this, there are lawyers and homeschool advocates. Yeah, but you're trampling on our freedom to beat our children to death. I probably shouldn't even do the funny voice, should I? Well, Ron and Raleigh noting, I've noticed there seems to be a weird sadistic streak in Christians. Sadistic, but also masochistic, Ron. You got to remember that in the earliest days of the formation of Christianity, the evolution of Christianity, I know no one can stand to think that but systems evolve. And so do institutions. Cults arise into, and right. It's a death cult. They worship torture. They think that agony is somehow an emulation of the Savior. Now, nowhere near 20% of America's children are homeschooled. Imagine if 20% were. How many more such cases would there be in this country? And if it were enshrined in some sort of law that Ron Paul had anything to do with the creating of, imagine how hard it would be to find out when the children have been tortured to death. Frightening, huh? Yeah. More than a little. Marty pointing out that the homeschoolers are also afraid their kids will get sickness from being around the N's and the S's and the C's and where N equals N-word, S equals Mexican slur, C equals Chinese slur, and I'm certain that Muslims and the LGBT community are also included. Oh, no doubt. Remember, the Christian Academy movement arose out of Brown versus Board of Education, and even some sects are not happy with that, and they want to make sure that it's not just the people whom children are exposed to, but the very ideas. Marty noting Mr. and Mrs. Pearl, creating tomorrow's psycho and sociopaths today. Cassie, up at college finishing up, of whom we are all very proud. Cassie said, "This is not discipline. It meets all the definitions of torture. Why is this okay with America? I just don't get it. Do the Pearls expect babies and children to be perfectly behaved according to arbitrary adult standards? And why do they think this will result in a healthy adult? Or do they? What is their purpose? Bob, this sickens me." And then, tuning out, see you tomorrow. Well, I'm sorry you're tuning out, Cassie, because I'd like to take a run at answering a couple of those. They expect babies and children to be perfectly behaved according to adult standards because the standards are not adult standards, but God's standards set down in a book of 5,000-year-old myths, Bronze Age myths for all intents and purposes. Perhaps some of them even Stone Age. And they never inquire as to, no. And why do they think this will result in a healthy adult? They think this will result in a healthy adult because they are doing the work commanded of them by God. And their only purpose is to make sure that they have beaten a child so that when that child has lived its full life, it will be able to end its mortal sorrows here on this planet and be welcomed into the hereafter. In a word, it's just like what Dr. Bill was talking about a little bit ago. It despoils community. It defeats community instead of building it. Bill, going right to the heart of the matter, "Send me this a-hole's address while I load this here 12-gauge. Now, Bill, put the 12-gauge down. Kenneth writing in says, "Bob, those reports sound like something straight out of the philosophy of R.J. Rushdoony, 1916 to 2001, and I might add the father of Christian Reconstructionism and the driving philosophical force behind things like the family and C Street and all of that Washington noxiousness. And that's in large part because it is, Kenneth, it is. And it's not just the Pearls. Remember, the University of Southern California gave an Ed D degree to a guy from Colorado Springs named James... Oh, for heaven's sakes. I knew I'd need that brain cell someday. James Dobson, who once wrote that a child should be beaten. Now, this is a guy with an educational doctorate in child psychology who says that a child should be beaten until he cries real tears, or she, which is, of course, the same thing the Pearls are talking about. Shocking? Horrifying? None of this is sitting any too well with Jeremy in Vermont. He says, you're right on the money with this, Bob. Violence breeds more violence, and beating children creates more and more, hateful little beings. Well, they're having their faith beaten into them. Because what you do in the first 5 years of a child's life goes a long way toward establishing personality, unless all the thinking and theorizing and understanding has changed in the last, you know, couple of days. Look at the converse of this. In the middle of March, in April, parents will tell their children, hey, listen, just because it's April, just because it's spring, doesn't mean Santa's not watching. Because you know what? Santa is. But at least in most cases, Santa never turns out to bring around the bundle of switches, unless you live in one of these to raise up a child families that follow the Pearls, or, you know, a stocking full of lumps of coal. No. No. So, again, this isn't just about what this story is. Although I found it, I'm really grateful to Dennis for sending this along, because it wound up working out pretty interestingly in terms of, because remember, it's not just the evangelical Christianity crowd that's into homeschooling. It's the libertarian, I'm surprised there's not an Ayn Rand primer yet for learning to read objectivistically as a 5-year-old. Because it's that crowd as well. It's funny how we sort of create these, or how these little connections create themselves, and you guys are on the watch out for them, and I see him, and then we all sort of pull them all together. Interesting indeed. Thanks to everybody for jumping out there. Kevin dropped in line to say there's a check coming in the mail. Beth stepped up with Henry. And between Kevin and Beth and Henry, that made 55. Then Francis made it 135. Then Kim made it 185. And then Jan and Jerry made it 225. Jan and Jerry sending a note, we want you to be here on the 30th and then again on the 1st. So we squeeze the piggy bank. All of those of us who listen need your sincere and honest conversation. Thanks, Bob. Jan and Jerry. And then Betsy took us from 225 to 425. I think we can do this. I hope we can do this. I sincerely do. So that's a couple of starting places for this evening. It's rather a it's rather a blunt edit to move into anything else away from that story. Or those stories. But I think it has a sort of cross-platform play to it. I don't know if you caught this or not, but President Obama went to the Navy Yard to speak in the wake of yet another massacre. On Sunday, apparently he slipped his Hannibal Lecter mask, and Wayne LaPierre made it all the way to the set of Meet the Prestitutes, where a smiling David Gregory awaited him. Wayne LaPierre managing to gurgle out the words, "We need more good guys with guns." No, really. On my Facebook page, Joe noted, "Where's my stinking toaster, Bob? I told you this would happen." And it's true, he did. And Wayne LaPierre, "We need more good guys with guns." Backing up for just a second, a note from Kevin. A question about what you just read. What was the reason given for those parents who took their near-dead baby to the doctor being so proud about it? There was no reason given. I guess maybe you just received the spirit of wisdom from the Holy Spirit, and or you get a word of wisdom, and then you know that, okay, you've let your child languish near death for nearly a year. That'll teach them. Right? I guess. Anyway, to go back for a second, Barack Obama went to the Navy Yard to talk about our little gun violence problem in this country, which once again, by the way, if you're paying attention to the for-profit media, has become once again a mental illness problem in this country, even though nothing really suggests that this is more of a mental illness problem than a firearm problem. But the mentally ill don't have a nearly billion-dollar lobby to go out there and speak on their behalf. Besides, the people from the National Rifle Association might shoot them. Because remember, the distance between lawful gun owner and awful gun owner is less than the distance of a trigger pull. But anyway, President Not Sure went to try to comfort folks at the Navy Yard. And, you know, he does give a mighty good speech.
Secretary Hagel, Secretary Mabus, Admirals Grenard and Lardes, Mayor Gray, leaders from across this city and armed forces, to all the outstanding first responders, and most of all, the families whose hearts have been broken. We cannot begin to comprehend your loss. We know that no words we offer today are equal to the magnitude, to the depths of that loss. But we come together as a grateful nation to honor your loved ones, to grieve with you, and to offer, as best we can, some solace and some comfort. On the night that we lost Martin Luther King Jr. to a gunman's bullet, Robert Kennedy stood before a stunned and angry crowd in Indianapolis, and he broke the terrible news. And in the anguish of that moment, he turned to the words of an ancient Greek poet, Aeschylus. Even in our sleep, pain, which we cannot forget, falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God.
It should probably be noticed that Aeschylus was not talking about the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky. Wisdom from God? That would be Athena, maybe? Yeah, anyway. Like I said, he does a real good speech, but let's move forward just a hair.
The heartbreaking interviews with families. After all the speeches and all the punditry and all the commentary, nothing happens. Alongside the anguish of these American families, alongside the accumulated outrage so many of us feel, sometimes I fear there's a creeping resignation that these tragedies are just somehow the way it is.
Well, Mr. President, fear no more. The resignation isn't creeping. It is alive and well and vibrant. Because the resignation does not come from a place of mere surrender out of grief. It comes from the recognition that neither you, nor any member of the Congress, nor any member of any state legislature are ever going to get to the essential core of the problem. And the core of the problem is the Second Amendment. A vicious anachronism from our slave hunting days, Mr. President. Has anybody even told you that? The grief of the Navy Yard. The grief of Columbine, the grief of Aurora, the grief of Tucson, the grief of Virginia Tech, the grief of Sandy Hook. Is born out of the insistence of slaveholders that they be able to form mercenary mobs to go and hunt down human beings who wished no longer to be owned by another human being. And when something is born from a practice as vile and pernicious as that, then everything that grows from it will be equally toxic. You cannot prune back the evil parts. You cannot cleave away the viciousness. You can't trim the hate. Because the whole thing from the taproot up is nothing but viciousness and evil and hate. And so don't be critical of people who are resigned. The resignation is the beginning of wisdom, Mr. President. The resignation is the understanding that this country is okay with the grieving widows and widowers and mamas and daddies and sons and daughters and cousins and uncles and aunts and friends and neighbors and lovers of those whom we sacrifice on the Second Amendment's blood-sodden altar.
we're okay with it. Ask any executive at any cable news outfit, Mr. President. These things are great for ratings. They drive viewership through the roof as we sit transfixed before our 72-inch flat-screen 1080p televisions and watch the horror unfold. See how quickly... he'll never know, but... I mean, remember the audio from the woman in Atlanta who stopped one of these things from happening? Yeah, the for-profit media talked about that for about 12 hours, and then they were done. It's good for business, Mr. President, and the business of America is business! How hard is that to understand? Of course, you're not okay with this, and I'm not okay with it. But any country that collectively was not okay with it would do something about it, and we do not do anything about it. And I include those of us on this side, whatever side it is, of this discussion. Did I miss it? Have a million people surrounded the National Rifle Association in Fairfax, Virginia, and demanded that everybody leave the building, that chains be placed upon the doors, and that it be marked as a memorial to slaughter and mayhem, and as a cautionary tale to any other future civilized? No, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. Let's check in with a few more of the brilliant words.
This week may not happen next month, but it will happen.
Oh, I went too far.
Because the difference that sets our nation apart, what makes us so susceptible to so many mass shootings, is that we don't do enough. We don't take the basic common sense actions to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and dangerous people. What's different in America is it's easy to get your hands on a gun. And a lot of us know this. But the politics are difficult, as we saw again this spring. And that's sometimes where the resignation comes from, the sense that our politics are frozen and that nothing will change. Well, I cannot accept that. I do not accept that we cannot find a common sense way to preserve our traditions, including our basic Second Amendment freedoms and the rights of law-abiding gun owners.
And in that moment, you know there will be no solution. Because as long as the Second Amendment is held out as some sort of holy grail standard which we must not transgress, we're toast. If we absolutely must have a Second Amendment, let's rewrite the damn thing. And let's do it in such a way that people who... Look, I mean, there is a common... He said common sense solution, didn't he? Yeah, he did. Well, here's the common sense solution. You know how Wayne LaPierre said that as soon as the good guys with guns got there, the problem ended? Well, the good guys with guns were subjected to, not subjected to, but had to go through a fairly rigorous battery of psychological testing before they were allowed to run around with the guns. And even then, because I got another story, even then it's not always sufficient. There are questions of our national paranoia that play into this as much or more as easy access to firearms. It's not just that we have easy access to firearms, it's that we have easy access to firearms and We are absolutely... mental illness? Please. I mean, I thought about it. I was thinking about it when I was watching this speech earlier. And I thought, you know, I think I'm going to go to a gun store and just while I'm looking over handguns, talk about which one would be the most effective killer. And then I realized I would probably be the one soul in the United States that gets turned in, and, well, let's not do that. But even in the case of this present shooter, Aaron Alexis, the people from whom he bought his firearms could not legally have refused to sell them to him. There's the mental illness. We've got a mental illness based on triggers. Wow. In exercising what they thought was common sense, the framers of the Constitution put together a system that could be run rather admirably by people of goodwill. And I don't think they ever envisioned the day that people of ill will would get the entire control of the government. But it's there. It is there. It is indeed there. And it's frightening. And it will happen again and again and again and again and again and again. That's not resignation, that's realism. Just is. Thank you to Karen. Karen took us to 525. And then Russell took us to 545. And then Duncan, our moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype chat and moderator in the Horn chat room, took us to 635. Wow. Thank you. Maybe we can get this dog away from the door tomorrow and not be waiting around to see if Monday will come. With the subject line $200 challenge, Darlene says, come on, Horn listeners. Help Bob out and save the horn. And she's willing to do that to the tune of matching the next $200 that come in. Thank you, Darlene. And in point of fact, if those $200 come in, we'll be right on top of having gotten the job done. Which is astonishing, brilliant, and humbling. So thank you. Let's take a little break. It's 10 minutes past the hour here. 10 minutes past seven in the Eastern time zone. Are we in daylight? Are we? Yeah, we're still in daylight time, right? Yeah. If you'd like to add your thoughts to this evening's More and Monday discussion, 304-658-3333 is the number. On Skype, the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn. Any way you care to reach out, email bobkincaid@gmail.com, Twitter @BobKincaid, and Bob Kincaid on Facebook. This is Conversation Radio, hanging on for dear life. This is the Horn.
In the timbers of the Canary. The wolves are running around. The winter was so hot and cold, rose 10 feet beneath the ground. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. I sat down to my supper, twas a bottle of red whiskey. I said my prayers and went to bed. That's the last they saw of me. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Pounds of sin spinning at my window. All I said was, come on in. Don't murder me, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. A wolf came in, I got my cards. We sat down for a game. My debt to the Queen of Spain, but the cards were all the same. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me.
Minutes, 14 and a half, coming up on 15 past the hour. That song seemed oddly appropriate under the circumstances. This is The Horn, and we are, well, this is a dire effort to try to save this little effort and see it get to its birthday. A little note, Betsy explained to me what why she did what she did earlier. The synagogue where she had been teaching summer classes finally decided to pay her what they owed her. And the two scholarships they awarded plus the cost of the supplies and books, she said she never expected to see that check, and that's why it wound up here helping us keep the whole thing going and the plate spinning and the bills paid and the wolf away from the door. Thank you, Betsy. Let's go to the phones at this point. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy, what's happening?
At this point, I think it's pretty clear that we still live in a fantasy world in this country where people dream of the day they're going to shoot a home invader. Either that, or fend off the government when it turns rogue and goes after its people and tries to take away its guns and pass laws it doesn't want passed.
I don't think there's anybody that, because see, I was about halfway kidding about going to the gun store and saying, well, you know, I don't know, this might kill one or two, but I need something that'll take down 50 or 60. Somebody would have picked up the phone.
I think.
Oh, yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, I've heard conversations like that in gun stores. I mean, this is West Virginia. Yes, I've been in gun stores. Yes, I own firearms. Okay? I mean, I do, but I acknowledge the reality of why. Well, I've gotten rid of almost all of them. There's a, you know, there's a home defense shotgun now. That's what it boils down to. But anyway, you know, you'll hear guys over the counter, well, yeah, I don't like the stopping power of a 9mm compared to your 45. I mean, I think a good middle ground would be your 40 Smith and Wesson. That's got a little bit more inertial force behind the round than say your 9mm does. But a 9mm's got a hell of a lot of muzzle velocity. I tell you what. I mean, they talk like that.
Right. No, no, and that's how people pick out their firearms. Is how it's going to kill somebody else. Now they're going to hunt a deer. Take out a fox on their property. That's how they're going to kill someone else. That's what I hear most of my acquaintances, shall we say, talking about their firearms, about these vague dreams of tyranny and killing other people that invade their house with another shotgun.
And you're in Vermont.
And I'm in Vermont. And, you know, I wanted to say a couple things. First night I heard you talk about how a Ferg gets picked on in school, or was picked on in school and bullied in school.
Yeah.
I'm a kid that went through that. I went through it for, say, a good 8 years. It does change you. You just have to let them know in the end, it doesn't matter. When I say it doesn't matter, don't take the wrong way. People will grow up, and once you're in high school, life changes. I have found that, for the most part, other than a few bad apples, most people in real life aren't out to tear you down and destroy you like mean kids are. No, I've done a lot of different jobs in my life, going through bullying. I've been in corrections for a little while. I still don't own a gun. I don't own one. Maybe that's just personal taste. And I have people ask all the time, why don't you own a gun? I don't need one.
Yeah, that's not right. Yeah, I mean, but what about the Second Amendment? And see, I don't know why I do the stupid accent when I say that, Jeremy, but...
They do it with a northern accent too, Bob.
Oh, I know. It sounds especially good with a Michigan accent, you know, Ted Nugent.
Oh, you know, I heard a pretty good song. I made a post on Instagram of it last night, a song I heard by the Insane Clown Posse. And it was only, they're so insane with some of the stuff they say, their rhymes and the bad language they use, but one of them was something like, and the F you, Ted Nugent, so what you hunt a lot. Who effing cares? And that made the whole song for me. I laughed the rest of the night thinking about that. And the name of the song basically was F the World. And that's why it was so bad. But, I mean, that right there made the song for me, that one line.
Well, it's it's interesting you would bring up ICP because I saw where they're getting sued by their former lawyer.
You know, they may be crazy, they may say a lot of foul-mouthed things, but they've done well for themselves. They've been around for 15 years.
Oh, yeah. I remember hearing about them back in the 90s.
Yeah, they have their own record label. They make their own movies, spoofs on other movies. So, I mean, people can say what they want. They get staying power. They've stayed where a lot of people have just faded in the distance with no record label being other than their own. And I'm not even a fan of them. I just heard this one song by Offshaw on... a comedy channel I was listening to.
Wow.
But I also wanted to say, you got into that religious thing about these schoolings of kids, and again, I think a large part of that is they don't teach enough God, not that I believe this, but these families believe they don't teach enough God in school anymore, and the fear of God, and the scripture.
Oh, no.
Anything else in life.
No, I don't, no. I don't see that at all. In fact, well, I mean, I know people around here who will say, you know, what we really need is for our teachers to be able to beat our children some more.
Did this all come apart on the story that Malloy brought up on Friday night? Because I missed the first 10-15 minutes of the program, but he had mentioned there's a story on Thursday about a lady, I don't know what state it was.
Alabama.
Yes, okay. Yes, so you heard this story.
Yeah, I had the same story in the stack, and for some reason or another, Friday on the front porch, we never got around to it. I'm glad Mike did. The consent form for please beat my children. Yeah, yeah. But the question, you know, you raise something interesting, and that is, why is it, and like you said, it lasted about 8 years, and I can tell you with almost pinpoint precision when it started for Ferg, middle school, when the hormones start running.
Yeah, it's middle school, and then kids form their cliques, and then one person says something, and then a little cuticle pile in on them because they don't want to be seen as the person that breaks that chain and goes in a different direction. Because in life, there's definitely leaders, and there's definitely followers. I'll tell you, there's a lot more followers than are leaders in terms of when you bully on a kid.
And what...
This isn't to say that I didn't bully kids in return. I did. I wish I hadn't, but, you know...
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, our experience was that we pulled our child out of the public school system to stop the bullying. And we tried our hand at homeschooling. And it's really difficult. If you want to do it right, it is really difficult. If you're not just satisfied to hand out little mimeographed forms from some Bob Jones University text that says that... That evolution is a lie and that fossils were put there by the devil after the flood to confound the unbelievers. No, it's hard work.
And I'm sure it is. I give people who choose to do homeschooling for one reason or another, other than maybe the religious aspect or the government's being taught too much in my school or not the right way, I give people that credit. I really do. I'm sure it's a hard job. I think teachers have one of the worst jobs in the world in terms of not necessarily easy to deal with, especially middle school and high school teachers. They deal with all these hormonal kids who have no right or wrong in life, basically, towards how they treat other people.
But I don't even think, Jeremy, that necessarily completely closes the circuit, because you've got parents who run away from schools because they want to teach them about the sky spook or whatever. But you've also got parents who, and they are a significant minority of homeschoolers, I think, homeschooling parents, who want to teach their children more. And in both instances, what they're saying is that the school system itself is a failure. And if we believe in concepts of public education, which I do, then those questions would be better sorted out sooner rather than later. Because at the same time, it just gives fodder to the right wing for the idea of shutting down the notion of public education altogether, because they just don't damned well believe in it.
You know, I see a lot of, I should say a lot, I see some similarities between our gun insanity and bullying in schools and older people my age and up. It's not my problem, or I went through it, why can't they? It's like passing on that abuse to the next generation. I just don't see how that can still work.
What you just identified is a matter of hazing.
Right, it's the hazing all the way around. And we've identified that doesn't harm a person. And I can tell you for sure as hell it harms someone. I physically have seen it pretty much. My sister suffers from some mental issues, shall we say. And I do believe that her hazing was significantly more than mine at times. And it really affected her. I mean, it shattered her soul, I think, as a person, if you want to call it a soul, whatever your being inside is. It changed her forever. To the point where now she is, no matter what you do, she thinks people are out to get her constantly, all the time. It's always... And yes, in some ways, that can be coming from her, but I do think it changes people.
Well, Betsy just offered some food for thought. She says it's not necessary to beat children, ever. There may or may not be something to quick spanks when preschoolers are behaving in a dangerous manner. I'm not sure. But most kids respond well to gentle correction and love and brief, even silly consequences. Students who come late to my class are the last ones out of the door. This costs them less than 10 seconds, but it works. Last year, when I taught elementary, the big consequence in my class was losing the privilege of reading with a friend on a pillow on the floor and having to read at your desk. When my son was young, similar things worked here at home. Can't play properly with something or put the toy away when asked? The toy goes into timeout. When a consequence lasted longer than a day, he knew I was serious, and even then I was just removing the TV cord, not beating him with it. This whole story is depressing, and I cry for the children whose parents bought that book. Bob, I've heard many people bemoan the fact that teachers can't beat children. I'm not one of them. And she continues, with regard to bullying, children who are beaten are far more likely to become bullies and to become the victims of bullies. The problem is that these parents want a bullying culture, or else why would they allow their 10-year-olds to beat their babies? And just as with the case over on my Facebook page over the weekend, I reposted something that Cowgirl Patty had sent my way about what's going on up in Leith, North Dakota, where the Nazis were planning on marching on Sunday. Are you familiar with this story?
I went to click on it on my phone today when I noticed it. I didn't get a chance to actually see it on the computer yet.
Well, there's a Nazi up there who wants to buy up the tiny little town of Leith, North Dakota, and make it a whites-only enclave. Every now and then, one of these weirdos will re-spark this notion of a, you know, they're going to plant the tiny mustard seed of faith that blossoms into the white separatist movement, and all the white people are just going to move up there and live in happy white bliss and drink white milk and eat white gravy and marry other white people and have white babies and white Christmases, and you get the idea. And it's stupid, but it caused enough of a storm and enough of a controversy because the people there don't want it that the Nazis decided to show up and claim the land that was going to be given to them. And so lo and behold, I posted it up there and, you know, talked about people pushing back against these Nazis. And immediately I got this libertarian lecture about how this individual, and this is someone I've known since childhood, he's an old friend. I don't agree with what they say, but I'll fight to the death for their right to say it, blah, 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 blah. And freedom is a messy situation, and yada, yada, yada. No, there's something I can't get on board with anymore there, Jeremy. I mean, does that make me some sort of an authoritarian communist or Maoist? I don't think so.
I think that normal human beings, not libertarians, not tea baggers, not tea partiers, not extreme conservatives, can all get along with that at some point. Not at some point. There's a clearly defined place where speech becomes hate speech, and it shouldn't be defended by a comedian, Tosh, for what he said a while back. Anyone, at some point, people should just stand up and say, enough's enough already, shut the hell up. And stop it, and take away that ability to do it. I do believe in that in a lot of cases. People can say an awful lot of vile stuff under the notion of free speech. They can go just so far and push the limits to hint at hatred, but as long as they don't go there, they can't be silenced.
Yeah, and there's...
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean... And this goes all the way back to, like, the Nazis marching in Skokie and stuff like that. And the so-called slippery slope of, you know, if we suppress those assholes, what happens when you're the asshole that somebody else wants to suppress? And maybe I'm just going to mark myself out as somewhat simplistic, Jeremy, but on the day that I start saying that somebody needs to be gassed to death or signing on with people who felt that way, I kind of got a suppressing coming, don't I?
Yeah, I never once called for the killing of people in any of my rants against this or that, of any kind of killing.
No, I didn't say, you know, up in Leith, North Dakota, I didn't say shoot the Nazis. I said stop them. You know, if they line up down one side of the street, by God, you line up down the other. You know, get your Harley Davidson riding buddies there to gun their engines, and drown out their Nazi-izing.
To jump back to the bullying, teacher beating subject one more time, and then I'll follow you because I've got one little fun tidbit to share with you guys. When I was in school, I just barely probably skated under the line of the age where teachers used to lay hands on children. Now, not to say I wasn't free from those incidents. One time when I was, I think it was eighth grade, a friend and I were kind of playing around, and I kicked him in the ass. And I mean, it was like more like a pat, and he jumped in the air. It wasn't a big deal. So I got down to the office, and we had kind of kind of a tyrannical principal at the time. He was towards the end of his teaching career. He was burnt out and just really kind of a mean guy towards me, I thought, personally. And he said that he was going to give me, like, an in-school suspension or something like that. I wasn't the best actor in school. I had my share of incidences. But anyway, that's not the point. And at some point, he said something which I thought was unfair, so I stood up. And he told me, if you don't sit back in your seat, I'm going to make you sit down. And I said, okay. He walked over, and I kid you not, he chokeslammed me into the ground. This was probably 97. About a month later, there was a school board meeting, and he was giving a speech about this and that. And my mom went, because I told her about it. And she stood up and basically asked him in the end, is it okay for teachers and principals to do that kind of stuff? He got red-faced and had no answer. He knew who she was and who she was related to. So I think it still goes on. There's still some people out there who don't know how to control their rage. And this is a principal.
Jesus.
When it happened, I popped back out of my seat, almost ready to go after the principal. I wasn't much smaller than I am now. I'm almost 6'2". And the assistant principal, who was always friendly with me, put his hand on me and said, do what's best for yourself, or don't do anything else. But I was outraged at the fact that this guy thought he could do it. And when I say chokeslam, it's almost like wrestling chokeslam. It was full in the cement floor.
Jesus. And no lawsuit.
No lawsuit. I still care at the time, so I'm in no lawsuit, but he retired like a month later after that, maybe 2 or 3 months later, but still. And then what tossed it all off is earlier this year he died, and a lot of people have these great visions of him as a great person and wonderful things he did, and they named the gym after him in that school. Oddly enough, his first name was Richard, shortened to Dick. Yeah, irony doesn't escape this guy either. And I spoke up about that, and nobody else would say anything about it. They just let it go as it was.
Jesus. That's...
So there's still a numbing silence when it comes to abuse, no matter how many years it was past and gone. People will not admit the heinous things people do because they can get away with it.
Yeah, and there's no getting around the fact that it's complex, Jeremy. But I think we just keep looking in the wrong direction, and of course some of that is deliberate, huh? Because in the wake of Newtown, and now in the wake of the Navy Yard shooting, you know, we're talking about mentally ill people. Well, mentally ill people don't shoot people as a greater percentage of the total mentally ill population than so-called sane people do. In fact, sane people do a lot more of the shooting. So
yeah, I would claim that too.
They broke out the video game thing. Well, you know, he played a lot of, you know, whatever. So.
I do believe in rare cases, if you're maybe unhinged to the point where you can't tell right from wrong, maybe games like, say, Grand Theft Auto V will come into play and affect you. I, on the hand, play it and laugh at the game because it's...
Yeah, but if you're at that place, so will a rerun of Bugs and Daffy.
Right, and I...
So will Wind Out of the South, okay? I mean... The causal link is too tenuous. If you snap that far, and frankly, that's kind of the standard that's used in a lot of jurisdictions for an insanity defense. It's called the McNaughton test, and it has to do with being absolutely unable to tell that your actions or know that you can't tell right from wrong anymore. You're so far gone, and the number of people who get away with a McNaughton defense, and I say get away with. The number of people for whom the McNaughton defense actually works is minuscule. Minuscule. The guy who, what was his name? Adkins? Who shot up the Tennessee Valley Universalist Unitarian Fellowship near Knoxville? The guy left a book full of, a shelf full of right-wing blatherhead books and wrote a manifesto saying how he couldn't go kill Nancy Pelosi and all the other liberals, So he would just go and take some of the people out who put them in office. The guy wasn't crazy.
Last week, say that he heard voices and that he had people following him around using a microwave dish to disrupt his thoughts or something like that. Didn't he say that? Don't people hear these things and they just go in one ear after the next and don't see the warning signs of some of these people who clearly are...
Well, the problem is with that guy... It's pretty clear the law itself would not have stopped him from being able to purchase the firearms that he purchased.
Right, because he was still a lawful gun owner in the law's eyes because he didn't do anything threatening to that point.
Right. I mean, it's...
Well, I'm going to let you go because now I'm not mad. I'm just mad at the general idea of the whole thing.
Yeah, I know. Just, you know, don't kick anything. You'll hurt your toe.
I know, right?
All right.
Have a good night, Bob.
All right. See
ya. Yeah.
Bye now. Jeremy calling from Vermont. Onward we go. Lines open, 304-658-3333. Thanks to Kim. Kim in New York City said, we just sent a contribution of $50. Wish we could do more. That's an awful lot. You just answered 25% of Darlene's challenge. And if we, with what Darlene has offered and what the challenge is, that'll get us awful close to getting things, the immediate crises taken care of. So thank you, Kim. Thank you very much. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah, you guys are, he was hitting home with me, but it was really unusual for me, Bob, to be pulled out of my house in the third grade and put into a Catholic children's home that opened in 25. And it wasn't anything that I did. It was problems my mother was having. And they stuck me out there, and I went from a grade A student to a kiss-my-ass student. I learned what I wanted to.
Right.
Hell, when I cut school in high school, they knew right where to look for me. Go down to the main library in the history department, and the short guy sitting behind the pile of books, that's him.
That's where you cut class?
Yeah. Well, yeah, most of the time. I'd sometimes go to a... There was a cheap movie show in downtown Cleveland where they'd have three Westerns, except the snoring of the wino sitting around you was enough to keep you awake. It covered the dialogue a lot, you know. It was just, Bob, it was a time, the 50s were a whole different time. Because in the 60s I started hanging out with hippies and pacifists and anti-war people and, you know, coffee houses were being run by churches in those days. And most of us were not very religious, but we liked those coffee houses because there was great chess players, and I used to play chess, and this guy wiped me off the board who was a black man who was who worked at NASA. He was in either math or physics, I don't know which. All I knew is he was one hell of a chess player. And the nice thing was you met people from all over the every walk of life, and every racial background, and every religious background, and you know, so you got past a lot. Oh, there was there was potential violence in the anti-war demonstrations. You never knew what you were going to run into down there.
Right, because among other things, you never knew when there'd be an agent provocateur in the midst of the crowd saying, you know, "F the pigs, kill them."
Yeah, exactly.
It turned out to be a cop.
I was playing on a Saturday night at one of those hullabaloos in Lake County, and some guys came in and told me they'd burned the ROTC building in Kent. And my reaction point blank was, somebody's going to pay for that. And the following Tuesday, what happened?
Payday.
Yep, you got it. And then there was a big shooting down in a southern school, too. I forget, was it a school in Mississippi? I think it was one of the black land grant type colleges that were very prevalent in the South. The A&Ms and, you know, that kind of places. Yeah, where they, you know, that kind of... So it was different. The projects gave you a whole... And you, when you're 5'6", you better fight or they're going to stomp you into the cement.
Or maybe you stay in the history stacks of the public library, Bill.
Yeah, well, what the hell good was that? I went to a picnic in later years. There was a lot of musicians, and there's a pickup softball game, and I go back and yank down a fly ball, and these people all looked at me like my teeth just fell out. They said, "What kind of musician are you?" I said, "Well, one who spent 4 years in a children's place where your sports were primarily. I was always a lousy basketball player. If you're 5'6" and can't shoot,
yeah, you know what? That there's not a basketball career there for you, Bill.
No. The coaches thought I'd make a good major league catcher, except I had one weakness. My grandmother could steal second base. My throwing arm was inaccurate and weak. So that was the end of that. But in a way, a well-rounded youth, you play some sports, you know, and in later years, I was lifting weights and wading rivers, you know.
Right.
For trout and life and working on cars and life was what was that? Wasn't that the universal feeling that the generations had that we were Americans and we'd do anything?
Right. Yeah. We the can-do country.
Yeah, that was the whole theory. I mean, the guys that taught me were guys who were my uncles and people like that. My one uncle, he was a master of the guys from the organization referred to him as a man with the golden hands when it came to repairing pinball and amusement machines and cigarette machines and whatever else they were making money off of, you know. So it was different. I look at kids today and I just feel bad for them because, well, I feel in a way, you remember Avalon Hill games?
Oh, I played a ton of them.
Yeah, I had Gettysburg up until a few years ago.
I liked Devil's Den very well. That was a lot of fun. But I also had, and it took a lot of patience to play it, because on all of those games, the setup was just a bear.
Oh, yeah.
With all those little tiny markers. I had the game with the biggest board that Avalon Hill had ever made.
Which one was
it? It was called Caesar, and it was the Battle of Alesia.
It would have to be big to be that type of that era, you know?
And the problem was, I mean, you could play the thing for a couple of days without resolution. The actual board game lasted longer than the actual battle because it was really hard to, and I always wondered about the reality of this, it was really hard to eliminate a unit because they'd always wound up in a melee situation, and then what?
Yeah, well, as anything can happen to after a point. It was like that in reality, too, with the... at Chickamauga, one Union brigade was ordered to close up on another, which pulled them out of line. And that was right. That was the spot where Longstreet, who was on loan from Lee's Army to Bragg's, Longstreet hit that spot. And if it hadn't been for old man Thomas,
yep,
it could have been a real disaster.
You know, there was even a recognition in the New York Times today over on their Opinionator blog.
Yeah.
From a guy who's been writing about Civil War battles, and he was writing about Thomas today, and noted, you know, the fact that Thomas did not turn treason.
No, that's where you and I are in complete agreement. I know that the war lasted 4 bloody years, and it was so horrible to every. I mean, 6 million citizens out of a population of 30?
Yeah.
You know what it'd be today with our population?
Oh, God. It would be unimaginable.
Yeah. And, I mean, and I've the Southern foot soldier, I have nothing but respect for, because they fought with the poor, all of them. And people don't realize those guys had no real medical help. They were issued their own food and were cooking salt pork on the end of a
bayonet.
Yeah, or what do they call those things? A ramrod. And they were eating garbage and the hardtack. Well, you got already made sandwiches. They were full of weevils. Wonderful. It's just a wonder these men could do this.
Yeah, you know the old saw about when you've got. When you've got two weevils out of a piece of hardtack like that, and they're out on the table, you've got one that's bigger than the other, and you draw a line a little further down the table, and you take bets on which one will win. You know which one you should bet on? Bet on the big one, because you should never choose the lesser of two weevils.
Oh, thank you. I like that. I'll remember that. I mean, that. Youth, though, growing up, there's not many guys like me that were you know, growing up, and this project was opened in 39. They opened two or three in a couple of years under Roosevelt, because they were trying to do something. I mean, people don't realize, there's a lot of kids that don't realize what it was like living in the Depression, because they don't teach that, you know.
No.
I think they pulled Grapes of Wrath off the read. It was on a reading list when I was...
I was looking on my Facebook feed today, and a friend of mine named Wendy, down in the southern part of the state, is a librarian, and she has added the Ralph Ellison novel, Invisible Man, to the... They've got, in a little tiny library in southern... They've got a banned books display.
Well, I read those two books, Invisible Man and Black Like Me, and they were both... You know, because when you grew up in an integrated neighborhood, your eyes were opened by the kids you played with. You know, you say, hey, these guys aren't different than us. Of course, we were on the underside of the teenage years. And hell, Bob, I was carrying what we would call a gravity knife when I was 14. And opened it a couple of times when it was necessary and watched people run. The same way with carrying a piece. I only had to pull once. I fired in the air once, and then I made a mistake when I had an audience, and I let go with another round of these guys' car. Thank God. I mean, I was, like, you know, you were talking about these guys looking at guns, and they're looking for the highest caliber thing they can find. My theory was, hey, man, if you shoot somebody, you better, that judge is going to want to know why you were two blocks away when you shot at him. Because that's ridiculous. I mean, to me, if I ever used it, the guy would have powder burns on it. And he better be about 6.5 inches, you know, a lot bigger than me. I'd have some excuse for being
But while there is a reality to those sorts of situations, Bills, and we know it because you lived them, the vast majority of people, like Jeremy notes, who are standing there at the gun buy-in counter, are never going to have that happen.
No.
And we know statistically that people who own firearms and keep firearms in their home are more likely to be harmed by their firearms than they are to protect their home.
Well, some guy tried getting in on me in a rough neighborhood in Cleveland after my first divorce, and I had a lab dough mix and a pit mix, and this guy stuck his arm in the door, and I'm sure he was sorry he did, by the blood that was around that door. He tried to pop the screen, and I was half in the bag. I had been out with my first wife for a dinner that night. Because we were still friendly to that point, so I'm half in the bag and I'm yelling, and I hear somebody falling on stuff on my porch. So the next day, did I go out and buy a gun? No, I went out and bought an alarm system, and the gun came later.
That and probably a couple of nice bones from the butchers for for the pups.
They were good dogs. Well, that was a weakness I had. They'd call me a hoarder because I had three or four that I... Because if you lived in the inner city of a big city, every time you turned around, there was a critter. They're looking at you pretty damn hungry. And, you know...
It's not all that different in the country, Bill.
Yeah, I guess. You guys have a little more get away with it because of the country, but...
Well, there's no leash laws and stuff, but... We used to jokingly refer to Agnes as Ellie Mae because sooner or later every critter within 300, you know, within a 3-mile radius of the house would show up to get fed.
Do they know a soft touch when they see one?
They don't just know them; they can smell them.
Yeah, I think they had me figured.
I mean, at one point in time, we had a watch possum.
Oh, Jesus! Yeah,
would come up and eat cat food. It got to where we'd just buy some cat food, and if anything came up on the porch, we'd know it at night.
Yeah.
Because that possum would set up a ruck. I mean, just make it, whack it, running across the porch and everything, and you knew something was up.
Yeah, I had a female raccoon that would show up every spring in a hollow tree on my front lawn, and I wasn't living in the country. But yeah, I was close to Lake Erie, and that, you know, made a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
One night I went out in the garage, and There's a skunk there, and here come the dogs, and I'm trying to get them back in the house.
No, no, get away,
and
get
open
away.
Open the overhead garage door and let that skunk out the front door. I must have come in through the dog run into the garage. And it's, oh, brother.
One of my buddies up in northern Wisconsin was talking about how his dog got into it with a porcupine.
Oh, geez.
And he had to pull the porcupine quills out of her muzzle. Oh. And he thought, well, at least she'll never get into it with a porcupine again.
Forget that.
It was a couple of days later.
Yeah, they are funny. I was out there one night, and I came home from playing the job, and here's my Jack Russell, well, who I found at a fishing lake one night when I was, because I used to bass fish a lot in the summer at night. One of your Kentucky neighbors taught me that stuff. And here was this little Jack. He'd been being kicked around the launch ramp when I went out, and he was still there when I came back. And he spent the rest of his life with me. So,
bless his heart.
Just a sucker like that. But you know, maybe because of the age where I sat and read so much about Kit Carson and this guy and that guy. And there was a thing I had called a Book of Indians by a guy who covered a lot of the major groups, the Eastern, the Northeastern, and the Seminoles and the Creeks, and the Western tribes. You got a little insight into what the geographical situation did to the lifestyle. You know, if you lived out the early Plains Indians had dogs dragging their possessions. The horses were not that big yet, but and the eastern tribes were, you know, the Algonquins and the Iroquois. And well, one of my favorite jokes is, you know, one of some of the eastern tribes are getting even with us honkies, you know, and the Europeans and such. They sell cigarettes. Here, have some of these. You'll feel better.
You take our land, we give you monkey for your back.
And beside that, come up to this casino we own. We'll get this goddamn country back $1 at a time and bless them. You know?
Dollar my ass, nickel.
Yeah.
That's what the nickel machines are for, Bill.
Yeah, I shouldn't say I was never a gambler. I did a lot of gambling, but it was usually this woman that I was leaving with, was she married, you know? That was the gambling involved there. You know? You don't know what you're walking into, but
now see, I'm gonna start getting tweets from Isaac asking you to tell stories that you're not willing to tell.
Well, I can't tell stories.
I understand.
They were, when I look back at my life, I said, how the hell did you ever do this? How did this crap all cram into 70 years? How did you do this? I don't know. It was a time and a place, Bob, because the culture was changing so fast. That war in Vietnam, that was like a LSD, which I wouldn't touch, by the way. I think, and heroin the same way. I had a buddy of mine one day, can I borrow your belt? Why? I want to tie my arm. He tied his arm off so he could shoot. And he said, you want to try this? And I'm thinking to myself,
nah.
If this stiff stuff could get Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday and people with that kind of talent, it'll walk all over you like you're non-existent. But I was talking to a guy in Lake County today. It's huge out there, one county east of here.
Well, remember, when we invaded Afghanistan, we also reinvigorated the heroin trade.
The poppies, yes.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
And
I left that alone, too, but I did have to make a realization about lysergic acid, and that is that my reality was weird enough. It really didn't need a bump or a boost.
That's the way I felt. I was whacked out enough, I didn't need any help. There's a book called The Day of St. Anthony's Fire that I read long ago, and I've seen that book criticized as being BS. But a town in France where they used to buy their wheat, according to this book, they got a load of wheat that had an ergot on it.
Yeah.
Which was lysergic acid. And the whole city went bananas. Now there's a new book that claims that this was a put-up job by the CIA and maybe French intelligence to check the reactions of people to this stuff.
Wow.
because that was real big. Again, that whole 60s thing, but I was just a little bit old enough and a little bit street smart enough to stay away from a lot of that. You grow up in a project, you're a Catholic, what was that movie about the kids? A classic movie and a book. Lord of the Flies.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that's what I felt like in later years. I said, that's where you were living. You just didn't know it. We had one kid who was such a mental case. The kid would, he'd just go wild, and the nuns would have everybody in the cottage beat the hell out of this kid. And you see this kind of stuff when you're 10, 11? Uh-uh. I'm surprised that I'm as sane as I am today, which is, that's...
No, I think you're screwed down pretty tight, Bill.
Yeah, well, but you hit 70, you better be. But I'm not really, because I still, if some, certain things would happen, I mean, I was playing until a few years ago, and I mean, I was playing three nights a week. Sometimes 3 days and three times a weekend. That was amazing. For a wind instrument player, that's a different ball game. Because, you know, we played, our players play hard if they're good at it. You
get
tone and... Anyway, I'll let somebody else up here, but this gun stuff, but then again, we were raised watching Hopalong and the Lone Ranger and Rogers. Autry, I think everybody but Autry carried two pistols. You didn't carry just one, you know.
Yeah.
You had to have two of those peacemakers. You can make twice as much peace, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, good luck, and I hope that things keep going, because this show is like a friend to me.
Bless your heart, Bill. Thank you very much. I do too. I think we can do it. It's just, it's going to take a little luck to, not luck. It's going to take a little determination to finish out September without being in a hole.
Well, these Friday nights have been eye-opening to me to get a chance to talk to some of these folks, because they have a lot to say, and a lot of these folks are, I could use the term street smart, world smart.
Yeah.
They've been through a lot and lived through a lot and seen a lot. And, man, I don't see too many dummies in the bunch.
No, I have the good fortune of having a brilliant set of friends. Because that's why we came up with this idea of Conversation Radio, Bill. I could never be that guy who sits behind a microphone and says dumbass things like, with half my brain tied behind my back, or with talent on loan from God.
You mean the guy whose father was a big-time Republican politician in Missouri, that guy?
Yeah, that guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, with the little street drug problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mother was in the generation where you went to the doctor to lose a little weight. We had a bottle of Dexedrine in the house, and I would pop one once in a while, because I was delivering milk at that time. You know, a home delivery, that makes you feel like an old guy, huh?
No kidding.
We had trucks. We didn't have horses. Thank you.
Yeah.
But, I'd be up too late tonight, and I had to be up that morning to work. Well, let me take one of these decks. But I would come home that night, eat, take a hot shower, and go to sleep, because I just had a conscious...
Well, and that knowledge. Stuff will wring you out.
Yeah. Well, I had a knowledge and a fear of some of the finest musicians in the world and writers and you name it, getting kicked into the hole by drugs.
Right.
And I just had, but maybe call it fear. It could have been what it was, but I thought these guys were better writers and singers and performers and you name it than I was, and goddamn, it's going to get me. Anyway, take care of yourself.
All right, you take care, Bill. Good to talk to you. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress. Calling from Cleveland, and thank you very much to Jeremy and Karen. We are now $20 closer to meeting Darlene's $200 challenge. We got 70 out of the 200 we need to reach, and I hope we can get the rest of the way. Let's keep it rolling. Lines open 304-658-3333 or on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn. Both work equally well. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Yes.
Yes, this is Karen from Maryland.
Wow, thank you. Well, it's wonderful to talk to you.
No, it's kind of intimidating to call. Your other callers are so good. I just, you know, and I sound like a 5-year-old.
No, so you do not. Like, now stop that.
I'm 40, so just turned 40. But you mentioned this issue of Wayne LaPierre coming on talking about, oh, a good guy with a gun stopping the bad guys with the guns. Well, my brother was in a bank in Northeast Iowa, Maynard Savings Bank, a little town about 800 folks, a community bank, just a couple of branches. And there's a big press coverage that it happened in November of last year. And my brother's a small farmer. He raises cattle. He was there with his son, his 4-year-old son. And two young men from the local area came in armed with AK-47s. And my brother didn't have a gun, doesn't believe in guns, never had any interest in them. And the banker, not a member of the 1%, he didn't have a gun. So they came in, they took the money. Banker signaled to my brother, hey, you know, go, lock the door. That was when the kids were in there, and they were kids. The robbers, the one younger one, was shaken, my brother said. Another one, 25, he was pretty much business, but they got the money, about $15,000. They got out. My brother went to the door and he copied down the license plate number and called the police. And guess what? When the police picked up pursuit of these guys, that's when they started shooting. And they shot an off-duty cop and then a couple of other guys. They were just sentenced last May, the bank robbers, to 25 years for 2 counts of attempted murder. So I guess the pace was 50 years.
And for the bank robbery as well, I hope.
Yes. Well, my brother didn't say, and it's none of this apart about, hey, they weren't armed and it got done and there's no dead little 4-year-old kids. You know, is that that bank, you know, then nobody was armed. That's, you know, then not, I'm not from, you know, gun totemville. So it's either that you have to have that to survive. It's just nonsense. But it never got picked up in the press. That point was never made in any of the local media coverage.
Oh, of course not. Because if it had been made, Karen, can't you imagine the number of outraged lawful gun owners who would have written letters to the editor claiming that the newspaper was somehow un-American for pointing out that it was not necessary for anybody to die in a hail of gunfire?
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, that's what gets to me at the end of the day, is that there, what President Obama didn't understand is the people who buy guns do so thinking about the day they get to kill another human being. And until we wrap our heads around that, there's not going to be any solution. As long as we're talking about video games and mental health, there's not going to be any solution. I mean, if a mentally ill person gets hold of a straight razor, they can hurt somebody. They can hurt themselves. But they're not going to shoot down 10 or 12, they're not going to kill 10 or 12 people with their straight razor. Does that make sense? I mean, but no, we've got to, we continue to play to the delicate sensibilities of the lawful gun owners, who are one trigger pull away from just being awful gun owners. I guess because we're afraid of them. Is that it?
I think so. Well, I think too, and I look at where I grew up in Iowa. This is, you know, a little tangent off the subject, but we're so ground up with, there's this association that being anti-gun is somehow makes you liberal. It makes you liberal means you're with the godless, you know, communist, homosexual agenda, you know, Barbra Streisand traitors, you know, just this whole, all this baggage. And if you look at the Tea Party, what generation are they? The 60s. A lot of them, they're folks that came of age in the late 60s, early 70s, the Vietnam era. you know, and to me that's kind of, that's my parents' generation. And my parents even have this, you know, this mentality. So anything associated with the left must be bad, and anti-gun is bad, and, well, we think some of the gun stuff is a little bit, goes overboard, but we don't want to be, you know, identified with those dirty commie hippie, you know.
Yeah, filthy hippies.
Yep. Yeah, no, it amazes me. I was in the Army for 9 years, and, you know, you'll come across people that, you know, they'll still remember Jane Fonda going to Vietnam.
Well, so Jane Fonda was in, what was the movie, what was it called, The Butler, or, you know, the movie, the fictionalized account of the man who was in the domestic staff of the White House for six presidents or something. Forrest Whitaker played him, you know, Forrest Whitaker, brilliant actor. Well, Jane Fonda played one of the first ladies, and there was a movie theater out God knows where, I can't remember now, but the guy said, I'm not going to show that movie in my movie theater because it has Jane Fonda in it, and she is the communist enemy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was, I mean, and I still hear it today. My husband's still in the Army, and I was, and I had just ended up my service, you know, right in the middle of the whole Iraq war, you know, nonsense. And I wondered, and
How did you manage to get out in the middle of stop loss?
I don't like to tell people this because I don't want to be identified as, I was a victim of sexual assault. I was raped.
I should have kept my mouth shut. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. Because you know what? You are one of the people. It's been a rough summer. I have heard people, you know, and I'm mixed because I know the issue, you know, and I want to use the euphemism sexual assault. Well, rape is rape. And you said that. And it's hard. It's taken me like 8 years to use the word rape, you know, because there's always the assault. And so it's been rough, but it's been mixed because it needs to come out, you know. And it, you know, so I want it to come out, but it's been really hard to hear, you know, constantly. But no, I'm not afraid to tell, you know, my story and what happened to me. If you have time, because nobody ever hears from a person that it's happened to.
If you're up to telling it, I think it would probably be of inestimable value, Karen.
Yes, I will. Hopefully my battery won't die. But anyways, so I joined up in 1996. I graduated from college. I enlisted. I'm a left winger. I'm a socialist. I had qualms about, you know, being part of the military industrial complex. Okay. But I was like, well, you know what? You pay taxes. It's a system. The Army's not going away. So we need to be represented. The military can't just be all right wing Southerners that want to, you know, rebuild the Confederacy. So I went along. I was a linguist. I learned Russian and Spanish. I was in for 6 years, and then I went to Germany. I was deployed. I was the 1st Infantry Division, and the 3rd Brigade deployed to Kosovo in just after the war. Well, just before the war started, so 2002. And we were there for 9 months, so 2002, and then in March, just as the war was kicking off, okay, I was still deployed in Kosovo, they had what's called the Fighter Management Pass Program, and we had a weekend pass. We went to Bulgaria, to Sofia, Bulgaria for the weekend, and they put us up at a hotel. I was a sergeant. I was the senior ranking female enlisted in my unit. It was a military intelligence unit. I was, you know, a night shift NCOIC. So I had credibility. This is, you know, a key to the whole experience. I had 6 years of, you know, flawless service, and I wasn't the greatest super soldier ever, but I was just a good, solid soldier in this unit. And so I was kind of a loner, not on the, you know, autism or the Asperger spectrum, but my social skills are kind of limited. So I like to hang out with myself. So we're in, and I hope that if you have any questions, please butt in, because if it's something.
Now, so far, you're doing a magnificent job.
Trust me, the tears have been cried for, you know, over the years. But so the weekend, it was March, so it's the second week of the war. Because it gets complicated. Everybody's situation, everybody gets assaulted. Raped. It's a complicated, they all have their own set of circumstances and a whole series of events leading up to it. And so mine was in things that got complicated and what got difficult to working through the system, was I was sent alone. Everybody's supposed to go with a battle buddy, and this was the worst unit that I'd ever been in, military intelligence again. And so they pulled out my battle buddy, so to speak. It was another female, so she couldn't go. So I went on my own. And then they had this stupid rule that, well, you know, you were supposed to have a buddy if you wanted to go out, you know, in Bulgaria, in Sofia. I happened to be a Russian linguist, so Bulgarian, the language, it wasn't a problem. I didn't have any problems. You know, I could speak Russian to the Bulgarians, and they could understand me. So I didn't really need a friend. But then there was a warrant officer there, and I met up with him, and we went out. And so we hung out together, but I didn't want to get too close to him. So on the second day, then, he had gone off, and he, did his own thing. I went off, and I went shopping, and then I went to a restaurant and had some brandy. But that was it. That was the afternoon. Then later towards the evening, I was in the hotel and I had come down into the lobby and I was reading my book. Well, there were some other soldiers there. They were two other sergeants. And this is the thing. I kind of have, like I say, I grew up in Iowa, a small farm. I grew up, my family had, you know, public assistance. I am a food stamp alum. I grew up on, you know, free lunches, but I went to, you know, college and then got out. So I always had this chip on my shoulder about my parents being like, well, just because you're smart, you're not better than everyone else. So,
boy, that message always comes out along the way. But by the same token, Karen, you know, you... Just by the way you describe things there and you're growing up, that's the way the food stamp system is supposed to work.
Yeah.
Because when children get to eat food and get to learn, they generally turn out to be people who don't need the system when they grow up.
Yeah.
Isn't that surprising?
It is. No, I know what you mean. So the two soldiers, I thought I'd go over and be friendly. They were mechanics, and this is the part where things start getting really wacky with the military law and all this. So I went over, so it's about maybe, it was early in the evening. It might not have even been 7 o'clock in the evening, and I sat down with them. Now, I had, it's a local drink, it's called Rakia. It's a type of brandy.
Oh, so that's it's rocket fuel. I mean, yes.
Yeah. And that was it. So for me, I was 29 when this happened. So, you know, I'd done the college thing. I'd done 5 years in the military. You know, I'm not, and I don't like to say this to insult, you know, 18-year-olds that drink a lot and get raped. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that to look at me and to try to say, you know, when you get raped and people try to find all kinds of reasons of you brought this on yourself, you did this.
That's one of the greatest shames of the system.
Yeah.
is that the first inclination, and, you know, it's because this is a patriarchal system, I think, in large part.
Mm-hmm.
is that we start trying to figure out a way to victimize the person who's already been victimized.
Yeah. So I had had a couple of drinks, and then that was it. I had gone over to the two, and I one thought that went through my head because I was kind of snobby. They were drinking Coronas, the two motor pool mechanic sergeants were drinking. I thought, oh, you came all the way to Europe to drink Coronas, but I like Coronas, don't get me wrong. That was about all I remember. And the reason the drinking is because I don't know to this day. I'm about 90% sure that I was drugged, and I have reasons, you know, to believe that. So I think I was drugged because by about midnight, I was in my room, and I think I threw up, and things were a little fuzzy. And then my warrant officer friend came back to my room, and I let him. He was a nice guy. And I let him in the room. And then the two sergeants had come back later in the evening. And then the next morning, things started to... I woke up. I was clear-headed. I was, you know, fine. I woke up at 7 a.m. I was ready to go. I couldn't find, you know, dog tags, my ID tags. I had my keys to my barracks room back in Kosovo were missing. And then I started to... I just kind of stepped back and said, huh? And then it started coming back to me what had happened the night before. I think they gave me what I figured since then, and I can only work from falsifying things, is that I think they gave me, what's it called, GHB, gamma hydroxybutanate. That course.
Yeah, known as, isn't that what they call a roofie?
Well, there are different drugs. This was the problem. This is what screwed up the investigation because the CID, that's Army Investigation, like the Army FBI, mm-hmm. told my commander, and the things just went out. And like I say, I hope the story isn't too long, but it was a long, because half of it was, okay, I've been raped by these two guys, and now the second part of it, now I'm going to have to battle my Army unit. And that's why there's these things. So the CID told my commander, who I knew well because of working in the command center for the MI unit, you know, being in charge on the night shift, I knew him well enough. And that CID told them that, oh, she couldn't have been drugged because you wouldn't have remembered. I'm like, well, there's one drug that it could have been. And when I looked off and just kind of, you know how you're looking for, you know, something to rule out it. Well, the only thing that I couldn't rule out was GHB. And so there are other drugs like ketamine and, you know, the other stuff. And I think more drugs fall under the, you know, the classes or, you know.
Right. Once they reach the street, the lines get, yeah.
Now, the reason that this is interesting is because this, right, GHB is, so it was complicated. So I got assigned to Germany, and I'd been there for a few years, and then my unit deactivated, so I sent to this unit that I was in Kosovo with. Well, the old unit was an aviation unit, and I had friends. I was one of two females in a company of 54 males, and it was the best unit I've ever been in. They were like my brothers. This is shocking to popular culture, but you know what? Women can have a fraternal relationship with a man and work just fine with them. And it's not condescending, and it's not patriarchal. It's mutual respect. And so I had met, and I have no idea why I had a compulsion to tell people, because I wanted to believe, because I wasn't clear on what happened. So I sat down with a friend, a male sergeant, and to this day, and, you know, he's from Tennessee, and, you know, the last person you'd expect to be enlightened about, you know, women and in the Army. And I told him my story, and the worst look came over his face, and he almost cried. And so I talked to him, and then he came back to my barracks room. This is on the base in Kosovo, Camp Bondsteel. you want, you know. And he had gone back to his unit computer and printed out all kinds of information on date rape drugs for me and brought them to me. And I said, they don't really do it. And he's like, yes, they do. They get the, you can get them from the, you can get these drugs from the taxi drivers in Sofia.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, and he said that. And that's the one thread, because I think my memory is not clear. I know enough that there's something buried inside my head that is so wrong about what had happened. And I hope I'm not running out of time, because there's some other...
There's no such thing here as running out of time, Karen.
Okay. So after, because I have, you know, I keep jumping back and forth in the timeline of the story, so I don't want to confuse you. But, okay, so I'm at the point of go back to where it's the morning I discover something's wrong. Oh, my God. So I go to the medic who is in the hotel in Sofia. Now, Sofia, Bulgaria, is about a 5 to 6 hour bus ride from Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, just to get the time, you know, kind of. So that morning was the morning we were supposed to leave, and I had gone into, there's a local MPs in the hotel in Sofia, and I said, my tags are wrong, I think something happened. Now, they were actually not unsympathetic. Now, they were all male. They got, not everybody, because some of these men were some of my greatest sources of support. And then others were just scum and just awful. So these guys were like, here, why don't you go to the medic and talk to him? And the medic believed, see, this is the thing, all the medical people believed me. And he was like, yeah, because I said, and I said, look at me, because they said when I went to the MPs to tell them about my lost keys and ID card, that, you know, and they said, oh, you were really drunk last night. You came down and checked in, because you had to check in so that they knew you didn't go off to who knows where or get kidnapped or whatever. So you checked in with the MPs or the staff. It wasn't really the MPs. It was like a staff duty, kind of, like a duty sergeant, and you checked in and said, yeah, hey, I'm here. I haven't disappeared. And they said, oh, you came in with them and you were really drunk. And I was like, huh. And I said, look at me. Do I look like someone who was so drunk I couldn't stand up? I was clear-eyed. I felt fine. I felt physically fine. See, because that's the thing about the drinking is when I drink, and I have drunk before, I would not be standing before them clear-eyed. I would know I have a hangover, so I knew something was wrong. No hangover. You know, I feel about as wonderful as, you know, I've ever felt. And then I got this experience from the night before that's starting to come in.
Right. You've got a hole in your memory that, but otherwise you don't feel like
something
you're...
Something very disturbing. So there was a little debate, do we take her to medical, you know, to get checked out in Pristina, in Sofia? No, there's nobody, you know, they don't know, you know, it's better to just take the bus. So I saw them the next morning when we were meeting up. Luckily, there were two buses back from Sofia to Camp Bondsteel, and thank God I didn't have to ride on the same bus. But they were there, and they had been tearing up the hotel, and they'd been just causing holy hell, because when they got finished with me, it was relatively early in the evening, and they had gotten into all kinds of trouble themselves. So we go back to Camp Bondsteel, and we had to take a drug test when we got back, everybody, and then I immediately went up to the medical, to the hospital. Camp Bondsteel. And they took, I will give them all the credit in the world. They're reservists. It was a colonel, a male from Monterey, California, and another reservist nurse. And I think between them and the sergeant, my friend, they meant all the, I mean, they really saved me, because my unit was horrible. They took my weapon. I carried it. You know what a M203 is? It's a M16, because I'm with a grenade launcher, so I carried that for all the time. I hate guns, by the way. But so that was it. So they took that away from me. And I was glad because I didn't have to lug it around it, you know, for a few days. And I stayed because I had nobody. What was I going to do, go back to Germany? I had nobody there. So, and I was only coming into what the heck, you know, what the hell happened to me. And it was disturbing, and I have clips of what was done to me. And the medical exam confirmed it. Luckily, like I say, one thing I say about Army medicine is I got the morning. I got emergency contraception, and I got treated for STDs, and then, of course, the rape kit. And that's just, and then things just kind of went downhill from there as far as dealing with CID. Was terrible. You know, basically they just wanted it to be, I had a choice. I could either say, well, you drank so much and that was rape, or if you're insisting that you didn't drink that much, you must have consented.
And see, both of those are maddening.
Yeah.
Because neither of them takes into account that a human being has a right not to be sexually violated.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You don't have any choice. And that's where things got complicated, because I mentioned the warrant officer to come back to, you know, draw the scene for you. I did have a relationship. I had sex with him the night before, and I told him that. I was honest, and that is an offense. I got an Article 15. I was judicially punished. I lost 2 weeks of pay. I was sent. I had extra duty. The Army's weird because they put me in charge of delivering chow food to auxiliary bases around Camp Bonsfield. So it's weird. But anyways, so I got in trouble. And the one thing I can say about the warrant officer is he told the truth, and he ended his career because we got nailed for fraternization. And I said, and this was, so that's where it ties in with the fundamentals. And I've always thought of calling you on Thorn in the Side Thursday. Well, my Thorn in the Side was the commander there. He's the son of a Baptist preacher from Oklahoma.
Oh, no.
A West Point graduate.
Oh, worse.
Yeah, so now you know what kind of unit I was in. And the thing is because I'm a relatively, now mind you, I've been renewed for a TSSCI, you know, a top secret clearance twice, you know, in spite of having library records and, you know, book exchange purchases of, you know, Marx and New Left books.
And, you know, maybe even Howard Zinn.
Yeah, and he knew that I was that kind of history person, because I always carried my books and I didn't hide them or anything. And so there's a little conflict there, you know, that came into it. But his attitude was, you had sex out of wedlock, you deserve whatever you get.
Oh, Jesus.
The fraternization. He was the one that essentially told me that, well, he was the one that came, because I confronted him. You know, about the whole issue of, well, I don't think I had that much drunk. I didn't have a hangover. It wasn't, because they wanted in the worst way for me to say that I just got drunk and, you know, and that, you know, and then I just had too much to drink and I woke up and regretted what I did. And I was like, under never of any volition of mine would I have had sex with these guys. I mean, I don't have a problem with other people. They want to go off and do kinky things. That's their business. But you know what? That's me, and I don't like coercion. So I know that unless I was impaired, you know, I wouldn't have been. So then I was on the defensive again. So you're constantly with CID. And the command, it was constantly on the defensive, you know, about justifying everything. But with the medical people and my friends and other sergeants, even men that happened to, you know, find out about the situation, you know, that I could trust, they were just lifesavers. So it isn't a consistent thing. You know, but again, I was lucky. I was a sergeant with 6 years service. You know, I was the you know, the night shift, you know, NCO. So I wasn't, you know, a young, new person that had difficulties, because I just feel for the men and women that are young, that aren't the greatest soldiers, that no matter if, even if I had a soldier who was just horrible and a pain in the butt, nobody deserves that. And that's not how the military was treating it. They were like, well, we'll listen. It was more of a, well, if, you know, we'll just talk. They just barely tolerated my story. I really feel for, you know, the younger soldiers that this happens to, because they don't have any of the power, you know.
And it remains to this day all too prevalent. I saw something the other day about a new Navy scandal. But it took tremendous courage for you to take the knowledge that you had and deal with it. And in military terms, Karen, a lot of times we throw words like courage and bravery around. Sometimes there don't have to be bullets whizzing past your head for those character traits to come into play. And I think you obviously, from what you've described, displayed tremendous courage and bravery. And it deserves to be recognized instead of being challenged, like you saw from the higher brass. And by the way, everybody in the chat room Sparky in the chat room just said, give Karen a warm welcome to the Horn family, because this is our first time hearing from you, and I hope it will not be our last.
Thank you. And just like I stayed around, because the story is just so vast, and there's so many points, you know, that I have to make that didn't really come out when they're talking about this all summer. And then in the aftermath, so my unit, I stayed in Kosovo because I liked my job. I liked being the night shift NCOIC. I liked the Army. I was sad when I left. And that's a whole different story about how, because that gets to how I got out in the middle of stop loss. Because what happened was then, so our unit got extended. So we did. So it's 2002, October 2002, the unit, or the last regular Army unit in to do the K4, the Kosovo rotation. That was my unit. We arrived in October, and we stayed until June. We're supposed to be 6 months, so we got extended, and so this had happened in March, and so I ended up staying and serving out my Article 15, and I stayed until July of 2003. So the war had started in March, and the attitude was sort of like, well, you're just lucky you're not going to Iraq, you know, to get killed, so we don't, you know, so getting the psychiatric help was a challenge, because their attitude was, well, you weren't in combat, you know. But I demanded it, because I had it, and it ended up, so we redeploy in July, and I go back to the unit. And as far as my time in Germany was coming to an end, I was supposed to go back, you know, to either extend in Germany or come back to the States. But then that's when the stop loss happened. And the thing is that I was, you know, trying to get care, you know, and so if you were leaving Germany, then you weren't going to deploy with 1st Infantry Division to OIF-2, so it would have been the second rotation of OIF-2. So things got complicated with the line. It just so happened that I had my little crisis thing predated the point where they could say, oh, well, you're just trying to get out of deploying. You know, so that they couldn't pin that on me, but I had demanded, I was like, you know, the Army broke me, I'm staying in, because their attitude, they just wanted to medical me out. And my attitude was, oh, hell no, I have invested 8 years of my life. You are not going to land me on my butt as a civilian, you know, needing help. And so I stayed in, and luckily, there were some good people in the division. they got me a job in the G2, which is the higher level division headquarters. I was in the rear detachment, and I stayed in Germany, and the unit deployed. And then there was the problem with, well, the other thing was my clearance, was that if you get medicaled out, they will take your clearance away. I'm like, I didn't do anything wrong, not that I agree with
people
are doing with clearances, I don't. But I was like, I didn't do anything wrong. You people are trying, you know. And there was that was only one faction, and there were others, and they did end up winning out, and it was the commander of that rear detachment that took me out of that unit, and he assigned me into the division rear detachment in Germany. I served out my time, and I had over 8 years, so they couldn't recall me, and I ended up getting out. The ironic part was I met my husband. An amazing man, and this is the reason why sometimes as a liberal and a progressive, I feel, as a socialist, I feel guilty about being part of the war machine. But the war machine is not going away, so who's going to be running it? And I'll tell you this, you know, we went through with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and, you know, some people say, well, in principle, you should refuse to serve. Well, I was that sergeant. I had a gay soldier. And he was not a good soldier. But you know what? That does not mean you abuse him. It means, you know, you be a decent and treat him like a human being. And the Army wasn't his thing, and he needed to get out. So myself, you know, and I worked with, they got it put in charge of work details and stuff. And so there's a chance if you had subordinate soldiers, whatever, you could just treat them like human beings, regardless of the horrible time they might have. Besides that, but the thing is his boyfriend was in an accident, you know, and he came to me. And then there was another officer, a female pilot, and she knew, she's like, oh, I'll give you, you know, instead of persecuting him, you know, give him a ride, you know, to the hospital. So she took him to the hospital. And so that's how, you know, maybe it's an excuse and a justification. But the point is people are stuck, you know, in things that aren't right, and it's a bad system. And you can leave it to the people like that commander from Oklahoma, or you can, you know, do the best you can and work in the system. I think it's a different answer for everyone personally.
And you also shed light, Karen, on the fact that it is far more complicated than almost any even well-done news account can tell, because these are intensely personal, intensely human transactions, and maybe even transaction is the wrong word. But you know, it seems like the bottom line is that having a determination to retain your humanity in the face of inhumanity is sort of the benchmark. Is that fair?
I think so.
Well, you're getting a lot of powerful responses here. Jeremy said, "Say hello to Karen. Truly, truly inspirational. A truly inspirational story of strength." Jim said, "My compassion for her situation is duly noted, with regrets for what you went through." And then Kate wrote in from the Front Range in Montana, Karen, and she said, "Thank you, sister. Good to hear your call. As a survivor and advocate, I can tell you that talking about it over and over is healthy and healing. And there are a lot of women who need to hear your story. We never know what seeds we are planting. Thank you for your courage. And now that you've called in once, please call in again." And that's the way it works. Eventually, the whole family commune thing will kick in, and what you and others bring to this program is far more than anything that I ever do, and for that I am forever grateful. And thank you for your help. And well, by God, it does seem like we've made a little community, haven't we? Well, you did just fine.
Thank you.
You said I'm not prone to calling in to show. We are very proud of the fact that this is a place you can call in, have a conversation, And you know, not have your blood pressure go through the roof, or be terrified, or you know, faint in mid-call or anything like that. So rest assured from the judgment not only of me but of a whole lot of other people. You've done just dandy, and when this thing goes up on the podcast, I'll get more emails about this call, because it is, like I said, it's a tale of courage and bravery that is seldom told.
Thanks, Bob. It's good, and the reason I felt comfortable talking to you is you've shown an insight, and the one thing I hope that everyone, if I could, you know, speak to the world, especially the commune, is men don't shirk. Look, you once said rape is rape, and it is, because it's malevolent and it's ill-intentioned, and you know it when you see it. There's no question. And so I wish men wouldn't be so, yeah, they always have this little guilty, they're not comfortable with the subject. They feel like they shouldn't have a say. But if you're, I don't want to drill into the patriarchal, but if you're a father or a brother, then you have something to say and you are a part of the story.
Absolutely. You know, that's why I don't understand that other mindset, Karen. The right wing fundamentalist, you know, the stuff we were talking about at the beginning of the program, because I am a father and I do have daughters.
Yeah.
And I would no sooner tolerate a young male, whether one is a man, I think, is another set of criteria. But I wouldn't tolerate a young male being disrespectful, rude, or God alone knows, violent toward any of my daughters. And neither would their brother tolerate it. I hope we have succeeded that far, it just in this little family, because I hear stories coming out of, you know, school, because Ferg decided to sort of screw his courage to the sticking place and go back in for his senior year, and he comes home and tells things that go on there that are just routine, matter of course, people grabbing at people and vile language that is shocking even to me, and you know, I've heard most of the fun words. And I don't understand that world, Karen. I don't.
No.
And when I think about the fact that the two dominant opportunities for young males coming out of this high school are the military or the coal mines.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of those are good outcomes for a positive future, because you know what? Up on the mountaintop removal site, they don't have non-rape training. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so when Friday night comes around, I've got a buddy who did some of the voiceover work for this program in the past, and he'll tell me stories of mountaintop removal workers who will stop in the parking lot and put dirt on their faces to make it look like they just come off the job, and they'll go in and, you know, just, it's too much.
Well, I'm proud of Bert. Just if he ever has a bad day, just something to keep in mind is he probably means something to somebody. He's probably very, very important to someone who will never tell him that. So,
wow.
You know, you just, and at some point you do got to take care of yourself, and enough is enough, but you can't let those people take over. I made my husband stay, and I feel terrible. I supported him staying in the military. He, like I said, I met him as a result of my punishment, because I got sent on leave, and I met a soldier of his, and I ended up getting out because he was an officer and I was enlisted, and I left the Army. But he's a West Point guy, and, you know, art, philosophy, and literature. so you can, it's a sensitive soul type, and it was awful. He did two tours in Iraq after the Kosovo thing, including 126 Infantry in East Baghdad in 2006. And I think West Point still stands out as the most horrible thing because of just people's mentalities. And
well, you know, it's interesting you would bring that up because
it's supposed to be bad, you know.
I've got another friend who is an Iraq veteran, and he graduated from West Point, I believe it was, yeah. And I asked him once because, you know, Ferg was interested in, you know, he's got a wide, and he also has to think in terms of how can I get college paid for.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we're sitting here looking at the bulb, you know, the lights going off on Monday because, you know, we don't have a printing press in the basement.
Yeah.
But in Ferg's presence, I asked him, would he recommend that to my young son? And he said, I'll never tell anybody what they should or should not do, but if I had it to do over again, I would not do it.
Now that, my husband, yeah, the same. Yeah.
And that's, that's amazing, because if you go and look at, like, the listing of America's top colleges and universities,
yeah,
without fail, West Point, Annapolis, Colorado Springs, they're all in the top 30.
I think they're cheating because my husband was not impressed. He went to Punahou. In Hawaii. They go to give preschoolers IQ tests and they scalp high IQs, and then somehow his parents paid for him to go to Punahou, a hairdresser and court reporter. They spent everything on that school. Well, he got to West Point and was not impressed with the academics. I mean, it was, no, if you want to be academically challenged, go somewhere else. They waste so much time. And maybe it's good for some people and they like it, but if you have this intense love of thought and learning and you're like a Latin scholar and you want to write and, you know, you have ideas, you know, unless you've got a spine of steel. I'll give him credit. You know, it was easy to figure out that I should marry this guy because West Point was so horrible and he stuck it out and he graduated in the top 10% that I thought, oh, God, no matter how awful I could be, he'll probably stick with me. You know, that bad. But, so I'll give him credit. For, you know, you give the institution credit for that. But that's, yeah. Again, I'm kind of biased in one person, you know, but you got to look at yourself and who you are, you know, and the sad point is we don't have all the choices we want to have.
No. And it is, again, just another one of those interesting little coincidences. Another dear friend of mine, he recently passed away in the last year or so, was probably a graduate of the same language school that you were. Because he was an Air Force linguist in Russian.
Yes.
And so, you're mentioning, you know, that specialty, sort of, yeah, brought him back to mind. But I appreciate you telling your, and I won't say story, because story implies falsehood. I appreciate you sharing this account of that portion of your life, because things like this change me and they give me perspective that I would not otherwise have, and I suggest that they I would surmise with almost near certainty that they do the same inside the Horn family. So I thank you for the courage that it took to tell the story, there's that word, to give your account. And like I said, now that you have now that you've made it through a long-form conversation here, I hope you will feel absolutely comfortable in picking up the phone just anytime you feel motivated to do so.
Oh, thanks, Bob. I'm sorry I wasn't quite as concise as I, yeah, but
you did, yeah, fine, really.
Yeah. So, but it's just these stories that people have in conversation, not radio, that's the good name, because you just draw in and your life can't be laid out like this perfectly outlined, you know, narrative that, you know, has bullet points A, B, and C, and they all connect, you know, logically to without any.
No, and even if you do, even if people do call in with their little notes and stuff, invariably, we wander off the far edge of the paper pretty quick, I think.
Stream of consciousness.
Or in my case, unconsciousness, Karen. I mean, let's not give me too much credit.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Bob, for what you do. Like I say, you brought me to tears with the story, the girl that was in the mud, the homeschooled girl. That was, I can't fathom.
I can't either. And I think, I mean, part of the reason that I bring those things to our attention is not for their shock value, but it is for their reality value. Because we don't want to believe, and that dangerous word being what it is, we don't want to believe that you know, that's not America. Well, that is America, and it's a whole lot more of America than we think it is.
Yeah.
And the question, but once you know about a problem, the question becomes, how do we solve it?
Yeah.
And I guess that's another day.
No. Thank you, Bob. And thank you, Commune. I like the Commune. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take care, Bob.
You too, Karen. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Have a good evening. Karen, with a first-time call, and the kind of call that I have never heard on any other sort of radio program than here. It just haven't. Because people do need to have a chance to put all of the information out there and draw conclusions and see where the conversation takes us. As we close in on the end of this this Moran Monday program, thanks go out to Bob in Virginia XX Fox Country of North Carolina, damn it. Thanks to Bob. He says, I hope the $50 I sent through PayPal will help. It will, Bob. Believe me. He says, I have great faith in the Horn family coming through to keep the conversation going. I'm so confident. I'm headed back to PayPal to set up a small monthly contribution. And he did, lo and behold, because there's a subscription page there, too. Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much. And thank you to Rob. Between Rob and Bob, just moments ago, Sal, we are now within $20 of reaching Darlene's challenge, which will mean that on the evening, we have raised, let me just check one right quick. On the evening, we have raised $700. And when the next $20 rolls in, we will have raised $720, and Darlene will then match it. And thank you to Darlene for the challenge, and thank you to everyone who has stepped up this evening. As soon as we get up to the level we need to reach in order for me to go and boot the pooch off the porch, I'm going to do it, and I'll let you know. Note coming in from Fritz in Arkansas. Subject line, Karen's courage. I appreciate Karen sharing her story as a new member of the Horn family. You get that Horn family moniker bestowed pretty quickly around here when folks realize how genuinely how genuinely this little band forms its bonds. It is about 5 minutes before the hour. And there's no way you can introduce a new topic under the circumstances So with that having been said, we will proceed toward the wrap-up. And again, just $20 away from meeting Darlene's challenge that will get us almost all the way to solving this most immediate of problems. More problems confront us, but this immediate one, it's most pressing. And thank you. Thank you all. It is deeply encouraging to see that, because I don't think you responded the way you did over me. I think it is the value that you place in this community that manifests itself in your willingness to keep it going. And with your determination, we will see the Horn's 8th birthday, October the 24th, 31 days away from now. Sparky in the chat room noting, we're still going to get the word out, Bob, and Will in Chicago following up, the work is not done. No, but if we can, Sparky says, the cavalry rode in to save the fort. Exactly. So thank you, everybody. Thank you all. Back tomorrow night with Titanic Tuesday. And whatever you decide to bring to the table. Because this is about the conversation. Thanks to you all, each and every one of you, and thanks to, I neglected to mention thank you to Robert in Australia, who also came through with his 20th of the month Down Under challenge. It is much appreciated, and I neglected to mention it at the beginning of the program. That should be added on to what's going on here, because it will make things even better. It'll make Monday a lot more likely. So we are $20 away from finishing Darlene's challenge, and that leaves $50 to be matched with what, with Robert's 20th of the month Australian challenge. Thanks all, because you are the ones who make this possible. There are no corporate ads on this program. No ads of much of any sort. It's down to us. Thank you. Thanks to the all-volunteer staff who keeps so much of the horn going. Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Thanks for everything. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.